We've been working our way through Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 45. And in these verses, as I've said the last couple of weeks, there are four stories that expose the methods used by the scribes and Pharisees to carry out their evil intentions towards Jesus. And Matthew also provides in these same verses the how of the meek and humble Jesus in dealing with the scribes and Pharisees. Just as a reminder, the first two stories dealt with keeping the Sabbath law. Between the second and third stories, there is a prophecy from Isaiah 42 that we looked at, which centuries before prophesied that the Messiah, that is Jesus, would be meek and humble in heart. The third story deals with the blasphemy of saying that something good God is doing is actually being done by the devil. And the fourth story is about people wanting Jesus to prove he has been sent from God by having him perform a sign of their choosing. So today, the goal is to finish the third story and see what we can learn from the fourth. Let's pray. Father, my prayer is, week after week, that you would speak to us. This is the living word. It's your word. You've given us the Spirit to teach us and lead us into truth. Do that today, I pray, in Christ's name. Amen. Starting at verse 33, I'm going to read through verse 37. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. For the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak what is good? For the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. The good man brings out of his good treasure what is good, and the evil man brings out of his evil treasure what is evil. But I tell you that every careless word that people speak, they shall give an accounting for it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. In responding to being told he was casting out demons by the power of the devil, Jesus said, either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad, for the tree is known by its fruit. Now that's not the easiest statement to figure out. But the basic idea is this. If a person is good, and by the way, we've talked about this idea just in different ways over the years, but if a person is good, do not call him bad. If he's doing good, do not call what he is doing bad. If a person is bad, do not call him good. And if he's doing bad, do not call it good. In other words, every good thing a person does, every good character quality a person has, every good intention of that person is to be recognized as good. Doesn't matter who the person is. If a person does things that are selfish and sinful, and in so doing exposes unloving and ungodly character qualities and bad intentions, it doesn't matter who the person is, those things are to be called bad. But how can we know what is good or bad in a person, or in what the person does? Jesus talks about both things, what is in the person and what the person does. And we can know what is good or bad by examining the outcome or the effect on others of what is said and done. This is not unique to what Christ is teaching. We do this all the time. The way people treat you determines how you think of them. And if they're treating you well, you think of them as good. And if they're treating you bad, you think of them as bad. We do this just naturally. For example, you should ask yourself when observing somebody and what they're doing, who does it help or who does it hurt? Is it loving or unloving? Is it kind or unkind? Is it thoughtful or careless? These are just simple questions that you can consider when you're observing somebody and deciding if they, in their character, from their heart, or if in what they're doing, is good or bad. So what's the point of all this? The point is we are to be realistic and honest about a person, or a group, or an organization, or even a situation. Why? Because God looked beyond our sinfulness to see if there was something good, something worth redeeming in us. And he decided there was. There may not have been much. It may have been just a spark, just a little bit. I know probably each of us thinks, well, when God was looking at me, he saw a lot of good. But the reality is, it may have been just a little bit. And yet, he looked, and the good he saw, he recognized, and he acted accordingly. Therefore, like him, we are to have an honest, balanced perspective that is reasonable, fair, unbiased, hopeful, and therefore godly toward other people. This kind of godly perspective doesn't exaggerate the bad or the good. It doesn't distort the truth or expand on the evil. It takes a balanced perspective. One of the things that has been a real benefit to me is coming to terms with this truth in my own life. Will I look at people and see both sides that are there? Not just the good, not just the bad, but to see the person as a whole. What is the good? What is the bad? And will I do that without despising the bad that I see or overpraising the good that is there? Can I even keep that part balanced? Most of us adults in this, well, in fact, all of us adults in this room today are married. We have a spouse. When you're happy with your spouse, it's easy to think of all the good things. When you're unhappy, it's easy to think of all the bad things. Happy or unhappy, will you be honest? Will you see the good and the bad? See it as a balanced whole, a complete perspective. We are to judge according to truth, not according to our feelings or our biases or our preconceived notions or what we're tired of or what we wish we had or what the world around us is trying to pressure us into judging. The Pharisees abandoned this fair-minded, godly perspective and spoke evil of Jesus because he stood in the way of what they wanted and what they believed they deserved and he seemed to be getting. In twisting the truth to fit their self-serving point of view, they fed pride in themselves. They fed ill will in themselves. They fed contempt towards others in themselves. They fed animosity towards others. And eventually, after feeding all of this, they became openly hostile towards Jesus and were complicit in murdering him. You see, they not only hurt their own character in these ways, which they did, and they not only hurt Jesus, which they did, but they also led the people around them astray who followed them and hurt them as well. When we exaggerate in either direction, exaggerate the good or exaggerate the bad, we do it because it serves a need in us, not because it's honest or fair or right or true. And when we serve a need like that in ourselves, we hurt our own character. We hurt the person that we're dealing with, even if we're overpraising them. And we hurt the people that follow us. I was in a conversation one time, and I would have not thought to put it this way, but the person said it really well. We were talking about somebody and praising the person, and this person spoke up and said, you know, it's like praising a four-year-old for playing a song on the piano, and even though they missed a few notes, you praise them as if it was a concert pianist who had just played an hour concert on that piano without missing any notes. And yes, you know, we like to praise children, and we ought to praise them. We're taught to praise them. Our current culture insists that we praise them. Are we really doing them a kindness when we praise them in those kind of ways? We could tell them that was a good job. We really enjoyed it. Thanks for doing that. Think about what it does to us, what it does to others, what it does to the person we're either praising or condemning when we exaggerate the truth. Jesus went on to say, "You brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak what is good? For the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart. The good man brings out of his good treasure what is good, and the evil man brings out of his evil treasure what is evil." I don't know if you've ever thought about this. Possibly you have. Hopefully you have. But if you haven't, think about it today. When people feel free to say whatever they want, or when they are venting or expressing deeply felt feelings, or are driven by a strong sense of need, or are passionate about something, or when they're angry or even drunk, they tend to forget to guard their tongue. And that is when they say what is in their heart. You see, it's in those moments that your heart sees no reason to speak anything other than what is there. It's in those moments when you're so passionate or angry or needy or venting that you just want to get out what's really there. In other moments, you've got the guards on those lips and you would never let those words out of your mouth. This was true for that brood of vipers that we know as the scribes and Pharisees, bad people that they are, but it's also true of us. It's true of me. You see, we all know how to guard our tongue and say what we must to get what we want or to look better than we are. And yet, even then, what we are guardedly saying reveals who we are. For in those moments, we're choosing to pretend we are what we aren't. Are we not? Yes, we are. And this is a form of hypocrisy, and that hypocrisy comes from within our heart. The reality is, if love, compassion, kindness, humility, tenderness, and patience are alive and growing within us, if truth and justice and keeping a balanced perspective are at least alive and growing within us, if we have a heartfelt gratitude for God's kindness in spite of what we deserve, if we are committed to putting good into a relationship or a situation regardless of what we receive, if we want our life to give others a reason to glorify God, then those deeply held beliefs and values and qualities of character will powerfully influence how we talk, when we talk, and what we say. It's for this reason that Jesus says, the good person brings out of his good treasure, that is, out of his heart, out of his values, out of his beliefs, the good person brings out of his good treasure what is good, and the evil person brings out of his evil treasure, that is, out of his values and beliefs, what is evil. I guess we've all been in a setting, I would guess we've all been in a setting, where it's hard to get a word in edgewise. I used to compete for time. I'm well satisfied just to sit and listen and observe how other people are competing for time, trying to get their words in edgewise, as it were, just trying to fit what they got to say into that conversation. And it's an interesting thing to observe how many of us have to talk, have to be heard, have to express ourselves. Now, there's nothing wrong with good conversation. I am not condemning that in any way, shape, or form. But why do we have to be heard? Why do we have to talk? Why do we have to get our point across, to say what's on our mind, to tell our story? Well, we have to, because that's what's in our heart. We're driven by what's inside of us. This isn't just the moment. It's who we are as a person. And because it's from deep within that comes the reality of who we are, we can conclude that the Pharisees' blasphemy of Jesus was intentional. It wasn't just a mistake. It wasn't just a bad moment. It was intentional because it came from their heart, a heart that holds the beliefs and values they treasure the most. And though we may try to justify having said something we should not have said by claiming it was said in anger or out of hurt or from frustration, it doesn't change the fact that what we said came from what is deep within, the values and the beliefs that we hold in our heart, and which in the moment that we said them made it sensible, or at least seem sensible and okay to say what we said. What do your unguarded moments say about what is in your heart? If you don't know, but want to know, and listen to yourself. Listen to how you sound. Listen to your tone of voice and your choice of words. Listen as if you were the other person. And if you will listen that way, then you are more likely to understand how they hear what you are saying. Listen. Don't just talk, listen as well. One final thought on this statement from Jesus. What is in your heart and my heart either opens us up to God and His truth, or it closes our heart and mind, in whole or in part, to God and His truth. This is true of you, it's true of me. But it's also true of those we are trying to influence for God and for good. This is part of what we're up against when we are outside of this room, working with children, working with adults, working with our neighbors, working with our friends, working with people we've met online. What is in our heart either opens us up or closes us to God and His truth. And I'm pointing this out because my urging to you is don't let discouragement stop your efforts in trying to do good and call others to good. There is nothing wrong with deciding you can't go any further and it's time to move on to somebody else. But people take time. I've said to you, what I teach today, it's likely going to be 4 years before we really see this in our lives as a whole group. It takes time. You have to hear what's being said. You have to think about it. You have to decide if you want to accept it. And then if you decide you want to accept it, you have to decide how you're going to start working it out in your life. You have to start where you are. And the reality is you've got a long ways to go. Then you have to persevere just to get there. You don't do that in one conversation, I can assure you. So don't get discouraged. It takes time to help people go from where they are to where they could be and hopefully want to be. Verse 36, Jesus goes on to say, "But I tell you that every careless word, every worthless, every useless word, every word that is of no value in terms of bringing about good, every careless word that people speak, they shall give an accounting for it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." I want to make this clear. I don't take this as if it is the hard and fast truth. I take it to apply to the context. And maybe I do that for my own sake, it may make myself feel better, but if I'm going to be judged on my words like this, I'm damned to hell. I spent a lot of years in the professional use of sarcasm. I mean, I was great at sarcasm. And really good at sarcasm when it came to putting a person in their place or expressing my frustration and anger at them. I grew up in a home where we could never talk back to our parents. That was a death sentence. But I did learn that if I said things in the right way, you know, like sarcastic, I would get the message across, but I didn't talk back. And it was in those years that I just developed this amazing ability to be sarcastic. I got a lot of words out there. So what are these careless words? These are careless words that not only hurt others and lead others astray, but they are words that degrade God, that speak of God or infer about God that He is not as good as He is. These are words that damage the reputation of God, that tarnish the honor of God, not really, but as if our words could. These are words that reveal what is in our heart toward God, reflect who we really are in light of God. and in light of God's place in our life. And we will be judged by our words in this regard, just as we are judged by our deeds. You see, whether our words are thoughtful and careful or careless and unguarded, they reveal what we believe, what we value, what we fear, what we hope, just like our unguarded deeds give visible proof to who we really are. I've said this enough times that saying it again may be of no value, yet when you learn to listen to people talking, it is amazing what you can pick up about what they believe, what they value, what they fear, what they hope for, what they think of their spouse, how they feel towards their kids, how they think about their boss. We reveal this stuff all the time. It's just amazing. All you have to do is just listen. Just listen to what people are saying. Our words do reveal what is in our heart. Of course, I know that we're capable of very rational, sensible speaking. We're capable of very meaningful conversation, as we prove when we're trying to please someone or impress them or get something that we want. We're very capable of that. However, consider this. When talking about people or issues that stir our feelings or our emotions or our felt needs and the like, such as being loved, or politics, or religion, or God, or money, or our spouse, or our children, or our boss, we reveal in our tone of voice and choice of words what we really think and how we really feel about those things. Unless we're really guarded. So I've said this already today. Let me just say it again because this is important. When you are free, or when you at least think you are free to say whatever you want, when you have pulled your guard down and you're just talking, you're not thinking I should be concerned about what I say right now. When you're free, or when you think you're free to say whatever you want, when you fear no reprisals or loss of anything you don't want to lose, it's in those moments that your tone of voice and choice of words expose your true feelings, your true thoughts, your true fears, your true hopes. And that's why God says He will judge you by your words just as much as your deeds. They reveal the truth. Now you might be thinking that in calling the Pharisees a brood of vipers, Jesus was talking carelessly and should be judged as such. I mean, how come He can do that and we're not supposed to? Well, I don't think this is about what we're not supposed to in terms of calling the Pharisees a brood of vipers. You see, these verses about our words are not for the purpose of limiting us to words of praise or words of comfort or words that build up the other person. These verses are about speaking the truth. And when speaking the truth, we are to call good, good. And we are to call bad, bad. Of course, we are to do that within the framework of a reasonable, fair, and unbiased perspective. And so, depending on the person or situation, we are to speak the truth in a strong, clear, straightforward way, as Jesus did in calling the religious leaders a brood of vipers. However, and there's a legitimate however here, There are times and situations where we ought to speak with a gentle clarity. A gentle clarity that does not compromise the truth, as Jesus did with Martha. Martha, Martha, he said, you're worried about so many things. It was a gentle presentation of the truth. He didn't shave the edges off the truth. He didn't build her up before telling her that. He just told her the truth, but he did it gently. And there are times when that's just as important as saying to somebody, you are like a viper. Fourth story. Matthew chapter 12, verses 38 to 45. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees said to Jesus, Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. But he answered and said to them, An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign will be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up, Queen of Sheba that is, will rise up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here. Now, when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, notice this is a full circle return to Christ casting out the demon just verses before. So keep that in mind. Now, when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when it comes, it finds it unoccupied, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and takes along with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself. And they go in and live there. And the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. This is the way it will also be with this evil generation. Now, it would be very easy to say, okay, that applies to the days of Christ. And I understand that. That's what the last statement Jesus made, is that is the way it will be also with this generation. But let us consider how it could apply to us. The evil and adulterous generation spoken of here not only heard Jesus' teaching, but they witnessed his miracles. Miracles of healing, raising the dead, feeding 5,000 plus people, 5,000 men plus women and children, and casting out demons, just to name a few. They had already seen enough, in my opinion, they had already seen enough proof to convince them to believe in Jesus and live accordingly. And yet, not only did they not believe, they were saying that if Jesus would just perform a sign of their choosing, they would finally be convinced and believe. I suspect the essence of Abraham's answer to the rich man. Remember the parable of the rich man and Lazarus? So the Lazarus died, he went to Abraham's bosom. The rich man died, he went to Gehenna, and he cries out to Abraham. So I suspect the essence of Abraham's answer to the rich man, when asked to send Lazarus back to warn his brothers to change their ways, would also fit here. And this is the essence of the answer. If they were not paying heed to Moses and the prophets, the Old Testament, which they had, and if the miracles of Christ, coming unto Christ's day, and if the miracles of Christ had performed already, the ones that he had done up to that point were not enough. So these religious leaders who came and asked this question, if the Old Testament truths weren't enough, and if what Christ had done already wasn't enough, And even if Jesus performed a miracle of their choosing, they would still not be persuaded. And on top of that, Jesus went on to say to these folks, the Ninevites only needed to hear Jonah's preaching, and the Queen of Sheba only needed to hear about the wisdom of Solomon. How about that? And yet, presently with them, Christ was with them. They not only had Christ's teaching, they had his miracles. They had the power of God exhibited through Jesus Christ. Still wasn't enough. Finally, Jesus likens the hard-hearted scribes, Pharisees, and I'm guessing the general population, to a person who has been cleansed from an evil spirit. Possibly likening that to being cleansed from idol worship and the evils associated with it. To our knowledge, idol worship was not commonly practiced in Israel in the days of Christ. Certainly it had been practiced in previous years, and God dealt with that over and over again, but apparently in the time of Christ, that was not a serious problem in Israel. However, evil needs a person or a group of people to carry out its desires. There would be no known evil in our world without people doing evil things. Evil needs people. The devil, the serpent, needed Eve. The devil needs you and I. And so upon realizing the one from whom the evil had been driven out had an empty heart because it had not been filled with anything else, it decided to move back in because it needed a human, a person. But he didn't move back in alone. He took seven worse than himself. You see, eight moved back in. So there's several truths here for our consideration. I'll acknowledge that. And I have enjoyed this story because it talks about potential ideas about demons and what happens to them when they're cast out and why do they have to have a human being to inhabit. Why did Jesus cast the demons out of the fella and then let him go into the swine and the swine ran into the water and drowned? What is all that about? So there's a lot of interesting things here. I acknowledge that. But today I want to emphasize just one. The only reason we turn towards selfishness and sin, and the only reason we hold on to selfishness and sin, is because it satisfies some sense of need or gratifies some desire or serves us in some way that we feel is important. And most often, we see that gratification or those needs being met in ways that are much quicker than the ways that godliness meets them. Who wants to give that up? Really, I mean, think about it. Hasn't it been a fight in your life to give that up? Does righteousness just come along and woo you and pull you in and make you say, yeah, I'm so grateful to be able to give up these sinful ways? No, it's a fight for most of us. Why? Because we like what sin does for us. We like it. So, the Bible has a remedy. And the remedy is we don't just put evil out of our lives. We don't just get rid of what doesn't belong there. We don't just put off, as it were, the old nature, to use a Bible phrase. we are also at the same time to put on godliness, Christlikeness, the new nature. Put off and put on. They go together. They are not to be separated. When you separate them, when you only put off what not, should not be there, you are leaving within yourself desires, longings, needs, whatever, that have to be satisfied. They cry out to be satisfied. And yes, self-discipline, you may use that and resist satisfying them, but they will win sooner or later. And if you don't have godliness to begin satisfying them, you will go back to your sinful ways to begin satisfying them again. Sweep the house clean? Yes, without a doubt. That's important. But fill it up with God, with Christ, with the Word of God, with the truth. That is also important. Don't ever think that you're a sinner just because you were born that way, or because the devil is victorious. You're a sinner because you want to be. You're a sinner because it does things for you that you want it to do. And throwing that out isn't just throwing the sin out, it's also getting rid of the desire, the sense of fulfillment, the sense of well-being, the sense of security, the sense of happiness that the sin was giving you, and turning to God and finding it in Him. And yes, it won't be as quickly satisfying or as quickly rewarding as sin is. I want to make that clear. At least it's been that way in my life. It's not. But if you will persevere, if I will stay with God, you will find out that what God gives you is so much better than what you had with sin. You'll just be shocked that you believe that sin was such a wonderful path to happiness and fulfillment. It's not. But it does take a while to find that God truly is. Good and evil, godliness and ungodliness, are a result of who we are on the inside. It's a result of what we believe, what we value, what we fear, what we hope for. I know you've heard these words. I know you've heard these words probably too many times. But they are still true. To become Christ-like, to love as we ought, to be holy as God is holy, to grow in the faith, to mature as a Christian, we must not only change on the outside, we must change on the inside as well.